Hello, welcome to this podcast. My name is Anne. I've been a volunteer here at Joy for 17 years. Please continue to support Joy. This is our 25th year and we need community support by way of donations and memberships. Support Joy now during Radiothon 2018. Head to our website, click donate now. joy.org.au.
Broadway icon John Cameron Mitchell channels the essence of his glam rock icon Hedwig and the Angry Inch for one night only at Arts Centre Melbourne this July. So put on some makeup, turn up the A-track and pull the wig down from the shelf. John Cameron Mitchell, July 10 at Arts Centre Melbourne. Book now. Joy sponsor.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday the 12th of June. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight marks the second anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida, in the United States. We speak to Jess Innes-Irons about her research into Australians' reactions via social media to the Pulse nightclub shooting and remember those who were tragically taken and injured. We also head to the launch of the hashtag We Are Pride Cup campaign, promoting diversity and inclusion in regional football teams around Australia. We speak to Pride Cup Australia co-founders James Lolicato and Jason Ball, Vic Health's Stefan Grun, and some of the players about Pride Cups and why they are so important.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
On June 12, 2016, our community and the world were devastated by the tragic mass shooting at Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, in the United States. A single gunman, Omar Mateen, entered the gay nightclub with an assault rifle, killing 49 people and injuring even more again in the deadliest single instance of violence against LGBTI people in US history and what was, at the time, the deadliest mass shooting in modern US history. 2 years on, the effects of this tragic event are still felt today, not only across the United States, but throughout the world, including here in Australia. Earlier, I spoke with Jess Innes-Irons, whom, having felt and seen the reaction to this devastating event, conducted research into Australians' reactions via social media to the Pulse nightclub shooting as part of her Bachelor of Arts Honours at ACU. Please note, the subject matter of this discussion may be distressing to some, and listener discretion is advised.
My name is Jess Innes-Irons, and in this project I was essentially the lead researcher under the supervision of Dr. Mark Lyle at the Australian Catholic University, which was a part of my honours research project last year.
Now, for some of our listeners who might be unfamiliar or have maybe forgotten what happened, can you just take us through a bit of what happened in Orlando 2 years ago?
Yeah, so in the Orlando event a couple of years ago, what happened was that an armed shooter entered a gay-identified nightclub in Orlando. And during the course of the evening, he essentially massacred 49 people within the club who were unable to escape. They were unable to leave because of the exits in the venue. And I guess part of the distress that people felt around the event was one, that it was a gay nightclub, particularly with queer people broadly in attendance, but it was also a Latino celebration night and was also during Pride Month and the celebrations that go with that around the US. So people really felt quite a significant sense of impact. And with that, the distress of the event actually spread throughout the world, partly facilitated quite strongly by the use of social media, which translated into lots of memorial events around lots of different countries around the world. The temporary memorial opened a couple of weeks ago, and they are using that as essentially partly a fundraiser to build the permanent memorial going forward.
It shows that there has really been a community effect and a need to reach out on this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really special about some of it is that the One Pulse Foundation, particularly, who is leading the commemorative events and even merchandise as well that you can buy online, and I highly recommend them and the great work that they are doing as well there, is that they are building a real culture around remembering and protecting what did happen there. And I think that actually started to show its head a little bit in the recent shootings in the Florida schools as well, with the Parkland massacre.
Unfortunately, in this year that you've been working on the details of your research, there has been no shortage of very just untimely and horrific events, particularly in the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's quite sad that we are seeing such an epidemic of gun violence across the country, particularly in schools, and that seems to be the chosen site of this type of violence in the US, which I think probably in part played a role in why Orlando looked a little bit different, because the school shootings are very, very senseless. We know that they're very targeted. We know that they're enacted usually by young people, which is tragic enough in itself. But then I think when we look at Orlando and seeing how, when I say Orlando, I mean the Pulse nightclub shooting, that one particularly was seen to be so targeted because it was in a gay club, and that was the thing that was really contentious in, I guess, the days and the weeks following the shooting and as people kind of tried to process what had happened.
Now, as part of your Bachelor of Arts, you were studying Australians' reactions via social media to the Pulse nightclub mass shooting. You've now completed that research and been able to tabulate your data, and you've found some interesting results, I understand.
Yeah, it was kind of a really broad section of results in that I looked partly at what community meant for Australians in the LGBTIQ plus community here, but I also looked at what the social media reactions are and the significance of that and why people react in social media spaces, and then also had a look at how that all intersects with what queer identity means in Australia today.
In Australia, we do have fairly regimented gun laws in comparison to the United States. Mm. Was there a strong reaction? Was there that connection because there was not only the geographic divide, but also that sort of political divide around gun laws?
It was an interesting point, actually. It wasn't something that I anticipated to come up strongly in the research, but it worked in two ways, that Australia's gun laws are quite different to the American gun laws, in that some people felt that it was a protective factor, that that would never happen here because we have our gun laws. Yet quite a significant number of people actually raised that they felt really vulnerable and that it could happen to them and that it could happen here, irrespective of our gun laws here. So I thought that was quite interesting, that people here felt really attacked despite what our gun laws may be here.
You might not necessarily be able to speak to it with any point of authority, but is it your opinion that this event and the connection with social media has any relation with what might be copycat attacks or concern about follow-on attacks?
I'm probably not in a position to, I guess, have authority on copycat attacks broadly, but one thing that did come out quite clearly in this research was that people were afraid of copycat events that would target them as queer individuals. I think there is quite a strong connection to social media in terms of that instantaneous and intimate nature that we've got, that suddenly we're holding this small device in our hands quite often. And it almost reduces that barrier between us here in Australia versus the people over there in America, and particularly in Florida, which is even, you know, further than the west coast of California. And so the most common theme that came out in this research was people's response that it could have been them who were attacked.
And in terms of Australian queer reactions to this event, did your research find any reactions in terms of Islamophobia or a sort of a segregating or trying to point specific blame, or was there an outreach of support?
It was very cool, actually. Not one person tried to call this Islamophobia or terrorism. If anything, they only called me out for not framing it that way and for not suggesting that that was an issue, which I'm happy to own that. That's not what my study was about, but it's an element here. And I think it just, what my respondent said in this survey just speaks volumes for how intelligent and switched on and emotionally engaged our community are with each other. And looking at how well everybody had each other's backs, essentially. I cannot phrase it better than that. These people in this study were looking out for each other and looking out for people of colour who were impacted this event. And they didn't want people from an Islamic faith to be demonised because of one person's actions, and were really quick to say, this is not what that event was.
That was Jess Innes-Irons discussing her research into Australians' reactions via social media to the Pulse nightclub shooting, with more to come. If you feel distressed by this story or have any personal concerns on LGBTIQA+ issues, please contact the team at QLife on 1800 184 527 or for web counselling at qlife.org.au. Or you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636 and at beyondblue.org.au.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
We now continue my discussion with Jess Innes-Irons, remembering the victims of the Pulse nightclub attack and her research into Australians' reactions to the tragedy. You brought up the Latino community and whether they have ownership or feel they've been properly acknowledged in this tragedy, whether it is primarily about the queer community. It's a lot to process.
Yeah, and that was one thing that did come up a lot in this research around ownership, because this study was framed around the Australian LGBTIQ plus community. And I specifically did not include the queer Latino perspective in this research because, well, really two reasons. I'm not a person of colour, so I cannot speak to that experience, and it's really important for me to recognise that, because this research in part was insider research. As a queer person, I can speak to that experience, but I cannot speak to a queer person of colour experience, and so I would never step in and try and speak for them. This research was really around doing research with people and doing it together and allowing Australians who felt impacted by this event to have a voice in what happened and to essentially memorialise it as well, because if we don't write this stuff down, then it disappears and it becomes anecdotal and it's stuff that we remember. So for me, it was really important to have this recorded in some capacity. And the second reason that this study didn't touch particularly strongly on the Latino element of the event was that our cultural makeup in Australia is different. We don't have that same geographic distance to Latin America. And so while we do have people from Latin American descent in our country, we don't have the same proportion, we don't have the same cultural tensions operating here. Ours are different. And so Australians cannot speak to how significant that event was in Orlando, but we can speak to how significant it felt to us. And for me, it's a point of, it's not a hierarchical experience of trauma and grief. It's just that our experiences are different.
Did your study find that there was any clash or misinterpretation between those two paradigms, and that one group might have a problem with the way the others are processing or going through these rituals?
Yeah. One of the things that was reported quite often was that people felt that only people within the LGBTIQ plus community could really understand what their reaction was, why they were having a reaction, and why this was significant within the queer community. And I think it was that point of contention that we saw where within media spaces, sometimes people were saying, no, this is an issue about gun control. This is an issue around Islamic violence. This is an issue around terrorism. And trying to, I guess, put the focus back on violence and taking that narrative away from the queer community, who felt such a sense of ownership over this, because people felt like these were our people who were attacked. Because I guess what happened was, when I was trying to explain my study to people last year, and people would ask me what I personally felt about whether this was a hate crime in what happened in Orlando, or whether I thought it was a crime that was targeted at people of colour, which I do think it is a significant element in this particular event. or if I thought it was an act of terrorism, or if I thought it was an act of gun control issue. And I think my take on the event is that if you wanted to kill a queer person, you could go and conduct a massacre in any club and you'd probably get one of us by accident. But if you particularly want to go and kill a lot of queer people, then you would go to a queer club and you'll get lots of us. Because queer lives are really political, and the space that we hold is really political, and that our safe spaces are really political, it became a political issue because inherently people still don't like us. That's why we see things like this happening. And I think it's a very smaller and hopefully decreasing population that don't particularly like us.
We were lucky enough here on The Informer to have you in last year to talk about your research while you were still putting it together. And I was hoping to follow up on a couple of really interesting points that you made at the time, if I could. One of the points that really stuck out to me was you were speaking on the ritual response following trauma and the effect social media has on this. There are still these rituals, but it's changed.
That's probably my favourite finding of this study, is that we know what a typical response looks like to a death or a loss or some sort of traumatic event in real life, to put it in everyday language, because when somebody close to us dies, we can expect that there'll be a funeral. We can expect that we will go through a process of probably grieving them, especially if they were very close to us. Whereas in social media spaces, because this is such a new platform that we're working with, we don't have an established 100-year-old traditions that we can go to actually process our emotional reactions to stuff that we are seeing online. And suddenly we are so much more connected to people who we don't know. And suddenly their lives can be intertwined with our lives, whereas pre-internet, if it wasn't in our local newspaper, we probably weren't going to hear about it. So with that rise of access to information that happens, we suddenly have a broader number of people and lives that we could potentially be saddened or angry about if there is some sort of loss of life or violence around those people or that community. And so the one thing I did find in this study is that we haven't stopped doing our traditional ritual responses to death or violence, in terms of that, you know, those things will still happen in our everyday life. But in terms of social media, and the way that I phrased it in this study is social media mourning, is that we're seeing a rise of new types of responses to events that upset us. And so where we might see someone post a picture, I guess the obvious example is a funeral selfie, which this study doesn't particularly look at, but that's something that was really contentious, and I think we've kind of seen it taper down a little bit in terms of how often we see those online now. But what I did find in this study is that while we've got these new rituals on social media platforms and we've got these old rituals outside in the real world, neither of them are necessarily replacing the other. So we've kind of got these old and these new, but we're actually finding this space in between that where they both happen together, which I think for me really helped to clarify that what we do online and what we see online doesn't necessarily replace what happens offline, and the two do function really well together. And people in this study reported quite a sense of healing and a greater understanding by seeing how those two function together offline and online. I think it's going to take quite a bit more research to get us to that point. We're really still building so much knowledge that we need around how social media operates, and it's very individualistic because suddenly we all are in control of what we do post and engage with online. I think the biggest learning that translates out of this research into our everyday lives is that loss and grief in response to traumatic events, it's not hierarchical. It's not that somebody in Australia should not feel grief over the Pulse shooting any less so than anybody else. We all have the capacity to feel impacted by this, and the way that some people in the study reported feeling really impacted, there was a couple of people who did report that they didn't feel impacted. And I think there seemed to be a bit of a connection between the amount of trauma or loss that somebody has experienced in their lives versus how much they felt impacted by this particular event. And so if we can start to be more mindful around the fact that different people will always grieve and react differently because we are all individual and we are all unique in our own responses, then ideally we'll come to a space where we can be a lot kinder and compassionate when we approach people who might be hurting about stuff that's really significant to them.
Has the research been publicly published? Is it available if people want to learn more?
Not yet. It's still in my process of, I guess, decompressing after what was a pretty massive year. So that's the next step in what I'm doing. So I guess in terms of actually being able to circulate them publicly, that's why it's quite important for me to be able to start to get this out into the community, because really, at the end of the day, my belief is that this research does belong to the Australian LGBTIQ plus community. So I'm very grateful to be able to share it with you and them. The people who participated in this study essentially contributed to my research quite significantly by means of I was able to incorporate their verbatim comments into the work that I presented for examination. So what these people told me was exactly what was represented in this study, and each of my chapters within the thesis particularly were actually framed by what people presented in the form of poems, because it became really poetic in the way that they were talking about their emotional experience and the intimacy they felt with this event. So as part of my own efforts to commemorate what this study was and what happened in the Pulse nightclub shooting and what happened in Australia in response to that, I'm going to share those poems throughout the course of June 12 so that everybody can have access to those as well. So that will be through the Facebook page that we've set up for the study.
That was Jess Innes-Irons discussing her research into Australia's reactions via social media to the Pulse nightclub shooting. You can find more on Jess's research at facebook.com/AusPulseReactionStudy. Once again, if you feel distressed by this story or have any personal concerns on LGBTIQA+ issues, please contact the team at QLife on 1800 184 527 or for web counselling at qlife.org.au, or you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 22 4636 and at beyondblue.org.au.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Last Saturday night was the third annual Pride Round of the AFL at Etihad Stadium here in Melbourne, between St Kilda and the Sydney Swans. Last week also saw Pride Cup Australia launch their hashtag #WeArePrideCup campaign, with support from Vic Health, promoting diversity and inclusion in the sport in regional teams across Australia. I headed down to AFL House for the campaign launch and had a chance to speak with James Lolicato and Jason Ball, co-founders of Pride Cup Australia, Vic Health's Stefan Grun, and some of the players representing, about hashtag #WeArePrideCup and why it's so important to promote LGBTIQA+ inclusion in sport.
5 years ago, the first Pride Cup was held in Yarra Glen, and it was really a celebration of diversity and inclusion of their LGBTI athletes. So from that, there was an expansion, and across Victoria, other clubs wanted to get involved and run Pride Cups as well to celebrate the diversity and inclusion of their sports club. So we created an organisation called Pride Cup Australia, which offers resources, guidance and education for those sporting clubs to be able to run their own Pride Cups. The We Are Pride Cup campaign is the campaign that's held to get all different sporting codes and sporting clubs to be able to run their own Pride Cups in 2019 and to sign up.
This all started back in 2014 when my teammates at Yarra Glen Football Club decided to paint their 50 metre line rainbow to show support for not only me but anyone in the LGBTI community. And 5 years on since that first Pride Cup out in Yarra Glen, there's now 11 communities across Victoria who have taken this up, from Shepparton to Hamilton to Gippsland to Geelong and Sandringham, you know, at all levels of the AFL in both men's and women's footy. But this is only the beginning. You know, this has all come about purely organically. The creation of Pride Cup Australia is really to try and help take this to scale. So we know that there are more clubs around Australia who want to do a Pride Cup, and we are going to create how-to guides, resources and education to bring it to them. Our goal is to try and see if we can get a Pride Cup in 150 footy leagues around Australia in 3 years' time. So we've set ourselves a big goal, but that would look like a Pride Cup in every footy league around Australia. And we also have an ambition to expand into other sporting codes.
It's really about changing people's awareness and perception of the issues, and that comes from long-term conversations and awareness building. Most people don't realise that the LGBTI community is 6 times more likely to commit suicide than their straight colleagues. It's an alarming stat. Most people probably wouldn't think that 3 out of 5 people, not just LGBTI people, but 3 out of 5 footy fans have experienced homophobia or transphobia in a football environment. They're shocking stats. Any initiative like this has to come both from grassroots up and to have that really strong leadership from the AFL and elite clubs. I think certainly having the match on Channel 7 and broadcast really prominently is really critical to get the message out mainstream. But most people are going to experience a football environment at their local grassroots club. That's where they're going to have their day-to-day experiences. So they're the ones, from a Vic Health perspective, we're really keen that as many clubs, you know, jump on board We Are Pride Cup, because that's where most, you know, most people in the community will actually experience that culture that we want to be more inclusive.
LGBTI engagement is all about the grassroots. It's all about getting those people on the ground, making the biggest change. We haven't seen an out AFL player yet because they don't breed the best sense of inclusion and diversity and the higher levels. The only way to get there is to breed that sense of inclusion and diversity and the grassroots levels and make sure that that goes out throughout someone's whole career, so they feel safe and included at all stages, and then they can go on to the elite level and not have to not be who they are because they want to play the game that they love.
Pride Cup, it started at the grassroots. Everything you're seeing here at AFL House today when it comes to Pride, it started at the grassroots, and I think that's incredibly important. 95% of footballers play footy at the grassroots. That's where we see high levels of homophobia. That's where we see gay people not wanting to be included, whether as players or supporters or members or volunteers. But footy clubs are the heart of communities, especially in regional areas, and to feel excluded from those communities or to feel like you can't be yourself in those environments, you know, it means that they're missing out on a whole lot of the positive health benefits that come from whether playing sport and the physical activity or just the social aspects of being part of a community. So that's what the Pride Cup is all about, getting into regional areas and allowing footy clubs to show leadership on this issue, to be allies to the LGBTI community, to invite them in.
For me, Pride Round is equal or better than the grand final at times, because it includes an entire community and it makes football take a back seat for a quick second. But we didn't realise the impact it would have, and I think we changed a really big dynamic through female footy at the time. So Pride Round is the biggest and the best round in my eyes. Last year our Pride Round was in Hamilton. It was like the greatest day of my life, so good. The pre-match luncheon turned into like a therapy session for a lot of people, so yeah. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's about building the pathways to broaden everyone's horizons, and country footy or professional footy, it's a great organisation to get that trending. If anyone has experienced poor experiences in recent times, I'd 100% encourage to get back involved in the sport. It's come a long way over the last 2 to 3 years, and it's only going to increasingly become a better environment.
The Pride Cup offers a tool to be able to promote inclusion and diversity through using education to the sporting clubs. So we promise you that we're doing as much as we can to make sure that each AFL and other sport code that is getting involved in Pride Cup is getting educated to the best of our ability to be more inclusive and accepting, so you will feel comfortable once again.
Yeah, look, what I can offer you is a message of hope. You know, if it can be okay in places like Hamilton and Shepparton and Gippsland and Yarra Glen, then it's possible that it can be okay anywhere.
That was Jason Ball and James Lollicato of Pride Cup Australia, Stefan Grun from Vic Health, and players discussing We Are Pride Cup.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
And that's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Tom Morgan.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.